thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2024, and you're listening to episode 395, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an exclusive online feature film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Furiosa, Mad Max, and the Modern Apocalyptic Myth. You can read it for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're continuing on in our series that we started with Planet of the Apes to cover some films that are coming out that are really based on franchises that have been around for many, many decades. This time, it's the Mad Max series of films that started a long time ago. And as a matter of fact, we were just noting as we started talking a little bit before we started recording that Mel Gibson, who was the main character way back when, he's almost 70 now, I guess, and he was in his 20s when it first all started. So tell us a little bit about this film series and the history of it and the story of these movies, because it's been so long that several generations now have been exposed to Mad Max. And I'm just thinking some of the younger kids or parents taking their kids might not know anything about this particular story because it was so long ago that it started.
Yeah, the Mad Max series. So it's, I guess the thing that it's known for is being this, fairly iconic collection of post-apocalyptic action movies. The series was created by a director named George Miller and began with the release of Mad Max in 1979. And I think in the article review I wrote for you guys, I have this very distinct memory. When I was a kid, my dad used to have this old gun cabinet. And once he upgraded to a safe, the gun cabinet was moved. And in the bottom of this gun cabinet, there was this old VHS tape. Who knows who those are, what those are right today. But there was this old VHS tape. And the sleeve, I have this very distinct image of Mel Gibson and this an all black leather with a shotgun. And it was the original Mad Max. And I remember watching it. It was a very strange film. So this series has kind of always been there lingering in the recesses of my mind ever since I was a kid. But that initial film, the one that I'm talking about, it introduces us to the title character, Max Rockatansky, who was originally played by Mel Gibson. The idea of the character is that he's this, In that film, he's a police officer, but in the later films, he's a former police officer who becomes this drifter, let's say, in this dystopian future where society has collapsed due to resource scarcity and nuclear war and widespread chaos and all that kind of stuff. So that original trilogy consists of Mad Max, which was released in 79, a sequel that was released in Australia as Mad Max 2. These are Australian films. Mad Max 2, but was given the title of The Road Warrior in the U.S. That was a 1981 film. People generally just refer to it as The Road Warrior. And then in 1985, the movie Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, which is probably the film most everybody is familiar with in the series because it introduced Tina Turner as a character called Auntie Entity. That's the one that everyone sort of knows, either the song from...
Yeah, it had a pop song.
Yeah, it had the song. I think it's We Don't Need Another Hero that Tina Turner does. And so people generally are familiar with the series as a result of that. And each film, it's sort of episodic. And each film, gets into the collapse of civilization, Max's, journeys through this desolate landscape. And the series is particularly known for these really high octane car chases, these incredibly intense action sequences that are generally done with practical effects. I think that's one of the things about this series that is remarkable, is that even, you know, now in the 21st century, looking back on it, these films hold up extremely well. In a lot of ways, I think where we're so accustomed to the CGI and the smoothness of the CGI, you know, seeing these movies, they have that kind of visceral appeal that the original Star Wars has, where it just, you can tell this is practical. You know, somebody did this. They dreamed it up in their mind and put this together, and they wasn't relying on a computer. It's pretty intense. Just to go into a little more detail about the movies, the first film because they're all very distinct, right? I think if you go into this looking for a kind of coherence, you're going to struggle a little bit. The first film is this really gritty revenge tale. And it shows Max's transformation from really a family man trying to keep the peace into this hardened survivor, after this, you know, biker gang murders his family. The Road Warrior, the sequel, is where the series really found its post-apocalyptic identity. So all of the stuff that we now sort of associate with Mad Max, at least on the level of iconography, you know, the look of the movies, the Road Warrior is really where that came in, because it's set in the wasteland. It features Max helping this group of settlers defend their fuel supply from marauding gangs. And in a lot of ways, the Road Warrior set the standard for the post-apocalyptic genre with its really distinctive style and action. If you ever, you know, think of, like, and the post-apocalyptic genre is very popular now, or at least it was in the last decade. The post-apocalyptic look, you know, the chains and the leather and all that kind of stuff, that's all Mad Max. That's all really the Road Warrior is what that is. You sort of owe all of that imagery to George Miller. And then finally, Beyond Thunderdome, it expands the universe further. It introduces us to this, you know, odd sort of barter town and the concept of Thunderdome, this gladiatorial arena, very much like the Colosseum where disputes are settled. That's sort of that original trilogy. Now, after a long hiatus, the series came back, and this is probably where most modern audiences are familiar. The series came back in 2015 with a film called Mad Max Fury Road, and that had Tom Hardy as Max and Charlize Theron as a character named Furiosa. This film really reinvigorated the franchise. It's a very relentless movie. It has very powerful performances from both lead characters, probably because the actors genuinely were miserable during the shoot. That's very well documented. But it sort of follows Max and this character Furiosa as they escape this, you know, warlord across the wasteland. Now, Fury Road received huge amounts of critical acclaim. It won, I think, 6 different Academy Awards. And it really solidified the series as a, you know, a major force to be reckoned with. And all of these were done by George Miller. So that brings us up to the new film, Furiosa, which is a prequel to Fury Road and follows the character that Charlize Theron originally played, now played by Anya Taylor-Joy. So that's just a brief overview of the series throughout history.
So it's really interesting that this series has endured. And why do you think it has? It's been 45 years since 1979 when it started out. And, you know, before we get into this particular film and this series, I always like to ask the question at the beginning when we talk about books or TV series or films, why should Christians care about it? What, you know, we have talked at length on this podcast, especially the two of us, just about the idea of cultural apologetics and how many years ago we published an article about how really visual media is the new books. That's what people are engaging with in our culture, film and television series and so forth. But why should Christians care about, you know, this really a pop cultural artifact? It has been a big impact because it has endured for 45 years.
Yeah, the cultural imprint of the Mad Max series, I think, it's a bit overlooked, but it really can't be overstated. it's become the influence for, you know, movies, TV shows, video games. I mean, everything from, you know, that very popular film, The Book of Eli, to The Walking Dead, to, you know, video games like Mad Max, Fallout, which is now a very popular show, and even fashion in a lot of ways, you know, the emphasis on leather and stuff like that. That is all in a lot of ways attributed to Mad Max. And that original film, just to, you know, talk about the significance of the film series on movie history. That original film, the 79 film, which George Miller made, I mean, that film was shot on a shoestring budget. It was at the time, it would have been about $300,000 US, but became this massive financial success. It grossed over $100 million worldwide. And at the time, it set the Guinness World Record for the most profitable film ever made. I mean, it's kind of hard to even fathom a film shot for that little becoming so successful, but it did it. Obviously, one of the most significant cultural, impacts, to use that word, of the series is the distinctive visual style, that post-apocalyptic landscape. This really rugged, improvised, cobbled together vehicle look has become a defining image of just that genre as a whole. The look of the Mad Max universe with, you know, that you know, pulled together technology, the punk inspired fashion has been emulated in so many other works. We mentioned The Book of Eli, mentioned Fallout, Waterworld that Kevin Costner did. All owe this very clear sort of debt to the aesthetic of Mad Max. The character of Max, played initially by Mel Gibson, later by Tom Hardy, has also become an iconic figure in popular culture. I mean, any list of like the greatest movie heroes or something like that, Max will always crop up on that list. Usually he's never at the top, but he's consistently ranked on those lists, which I think is very telling. Max's journey is very much a hero's journey. It's mythic in a lot of ways, and that sort of it sort of carries on the tradition of the American gunslinger or the Japanese samurai. You know, this lone, brooding character in a very chaotic world. That portrayal channels those kind of mythic themes. So beyond the aesthetic and the narrative influences, the series has just been a benchmark for action filmmaking. The stunts and practical effects, particularly in Fury Road, have really set new standards for the genre all around. Like we mentioned, Fury Road won 6 Academy Awards. I think it was nominated for like 10, including Best Picture and Best Director. When you realize that this is an action film, that's really quite an achievement. You know, action films typically are not the favorites of critics. It's certainly not the favorite genre of award shows and things like that. And yet this film received a lot of attention. And, you know, financially, that the success of that original film, like we said, was groundbreaking with this very modest budget, a really unknown cast. Mel Gibson was not a household name at the time. You know, this series has consistently shown that a well-crafted movie can achieve a really significant box office success without the need for a large financial investment. And that has paved the way for many independent filmmakers who, you know, can show that creativity and vision can triumph really over budget constraints. That's an important thing to know. As far as Christians, why Christians should care about this series. So, you know, we've established that this is a landmark action series. It's been around for ages, that kind of thing. Because of the mythic themes and overtones to the series, Christians can gravitate toward this material almost allegorically, which is really interesting. You know, The Lord of the Rings is not an allegory. Tolkien legendarily did not like that idea that it was some type of allegory for the Christian faith or something like that. Chronicles of Narnia, a bit more allegorical and overt and intentional. The Mad Max series almost in a way is sort of, you know, because it's so, it paints in such strong archetypes, it almost becomes allegorical. And it has, you know, a lot of moral questions worth contemplating. I mean, we see this even in Furiosa, the most recent film. And it sort of ties in very nicely with Fury Road, this theme of hope, the question of hate versus hope. Which one is more powerful? Which one is a more powerful motivator? Which one is more powerful in driving someone forward when they have nothing left? Those types of questions are, you know, sort of not subtly put before the audience. These are movies that depict a world where traditional societal structures have collapsed, leaving this really a moral vacuum that characters have to then navigate. And, you know, there's a lot of morality. There are a lot of moral questions. There are a lot of ethics and ethical questions at play in this series. And I would say that, especially in Fury Road, Furiosa's story, Max's story, you know, the central conflict, there are themes of redemption and hope amidst despair. I mean, sort of like at the climax of the movie, you know, spoiler alert, when they sort of get where they're going and they realize that there's nothing there, right? The sort of the thing that was driving them to find this, what they call the green place, they get there and they realize it's gone. It's been wiped out. It's destroyed. You know, the whole conversation they have, Max and Furiosa have in the aftermath of that. I mean, they literally talk about, you know, going back to the Citadel, finding redemption, finding hope, what it means to have hope, what hope feels like, what drives them on, stuff like that. So, you know, despite the, you know, the weirdness of the imagery, and that there's no denying that these are very weird movies, I actually think there's a lot there. There's a lot of meat on this particular bone. And, you know, it's one thing to go to the movie and just enjoy it as this big bombastic, you know, action movie with explosions and cars and stuff like that. But if you actually look at the themes and the story that's being told, I think there's real value to that. And it certainly opens the door for the cultural apologists to step in and say, okay, you know, we can act, the things the movie is concerned about, the themes the movie is concerned about are things that Christians actually can speak very powerfully to. So yeah, I think this is a series worth paying attention to.
You heard me say it a lot of times on this podcast, but we really would like to ask you to partner with us and give us the gift of your time by helping us out with the algorithm online, because basically algorithms run the internet, and the more something that is looked at or talked about, they will suggest it to other people. So we want more people to listen to this free podcast and be able to be equipped, particularly if they are Christians looking to engage with people about the truth of Christianity. But actually, this podcast is for everyone, because we hope we bring a lot of food for thought to people, whether they're Christians or they're not religious at all. And so it's been a while since we've had a rating on Apple Podcasts. Really, that's the best way for us to be seen. We only have 82 ratings, but I know more than 82 people listen to this podcast. So if you can take some time to help us out, that'd be great. The last one we got was from Leslie Joy 93 back in April. And this is what she said. Very thoughtful. I've listened to 2 episodes so far. I love how thoughtful the conversation is on controversial issues. Really focuses on understanding scripture and living life in light of that. So thanks, Leslie Joy, for your insights. And we appreciate your comment on Apple Podcasts. And I want to encourage all of our listeners, I know you're probably putting it off, but please do go on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating or review. Even if you only give us a starred review and not a written review, but if you could take a minute to just share what you enjoy about the podcast, we'd be so grateful. The other way that you can help us out is to just give us a tip, because guess what? We're subscription free. Nothing is under a paywall. Every single one of these articles, and you get a new one every single week of the year, is completely free to everyone. One way you can also help us out is to share them on social media, email them to a friend, tell someone else about the podcast and the journal. But really, if you help us out with the tip, we'd be very grateful. I mean, a subscription used to be $33.50, and now it's completely free. So if you would be open to skipping a meal out or a coffee at your favorite
barista place, that would be great. Maybe $5, $10, $15, something like that. Head on over to equip.org. And if you click on journal, you will see that you can go to Postmodern Realities Podcast. And when you do that, any one of the landing pages has a link where you can give us a tip. In addition, I don't know if you know this, but we have started a brand new podcast, and it's the audio versions of our articles. So if you think, wow, these are deep dives, I don't have time to sit down and read it, you can listen to it as you commute to work or as you cook dinner or fold laundry or run errands in your car. It's called Christian Research Journal Reads. You can subscribe to it where you get your favorite podcasts. So we hope you enjoy our new podcast, Christian Research Journal Reads. And now back to my conversation with Cole Burgett about the Mad Max series of films and Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Before we get into, you know, a little bit about this particular film and some of the particulars about the story, I just want to ask you, you know, after seeing this, first of all, it is rated R. There is quite a bit of violence. It's extremely bleak. And it does have, I guess, at the very beginning of this particular film, it does have kind of a hat tip, I guess, of the Garden of Eden when it's opening up and they're looking at this fruit and she's about to pick this fruit, this little girl, Furiosa. But it's so bleak. It is so incredibly violent. Do you think that Christians could even watch it? And there is no kind of nudity or sexuality, but it is rated R for incredible violence to the point of, and like you said, because of the setting being post-apocalyptic and just there's no morality anymore, the value of human life is not there. So it is just a rage-filled, just, I don't know, violent romp. And so I'm just wondering what you think, because we were talking about how important it is for Christians to be aware of these series, and it's one thing to do that, but should someone, you know, invest 2.5 hours to watch Furiosa or at least to watch Fury Road and Furiosa together? Because they are quite, you know, action-packed, but very, very violent. I don't know that I could even recommend teenagers watching it with their parents, even though there is no, like I said, nudity in it. Is there any nudity? I'm trying to think.
No. Well, there's some odd stuff in Fury Road, but it's what I would say is these are not gratuitous films with nudity or anything like that. I will say that the violence, and it's a good question. The violence is certainly it's heightened in these films. You know, that being said, as far as whether the films, you know, sort of value human life and that kind of a thing, I mean, yeah, I think they do, because it's always, the violence has to be framed in a particular context. I mean, you know, the classic thing to go to here is say, well, you know, the Bible is a very violent book. But it depends on what you mean by violent. Does it call for violence? That's one thing. Does it depict violence? That's another. And we would say, you know, the Bible is a very graphic book that depicts violence. Again, just, you know, read Judges, for example. That's always the go-to there.
That's true. This is quite extended violence.
Yes. And that's the thing is you have to question how it is portrayed, if that makes sense. What I will say as far as the violence goes in the Mad Max films, it is very, very gritty. It's not on the level of a, you know, a Saw or a horror film or something like that. Cause you know, I can't really even watch those films and don't even watch those films. And we've talked a bit about this when we've covered horror films here. And you know, I think at the end of the day, the question just comes down to the Christian, right? If the Christian, you know, feels as though they're violating their conscience by, you know, watching an action film with heightened levels of violence, then, you know, obviously don't. And that's completely acceptable and fine and actually right. That being said, you know, I've seen at least Fury Road more times than I can count, to be honest. And I don't necessarily see the violence in that film as being, you know, so overwhelming that it warrants a Christian having a crisis of morality when watching it. And that's probably because the point the story is making outweighs the violence. Again, it doesn't seem gratuitous. There are, you know, large battle scenes and things like that. But I would also argue that they're no more, you know, larger or, you know, gratuitous than, you know, the huge battle scenes in The Lord of the Rings, which features, you know, far more decapitations and things like that.
Oh, this seems more gruesome than Lord of the Rings. I guess the question I would have, because when people experience fictitious violence, they think it's more violent. So, you know, to give, I guess, Christians maybe a comparison, would you say it's more violent than, say, Saving Private Ryan, which is depicting World War II?
I mean, it depends on how you're framing it. I almost think it's hard to quantify one or the other, and here's why. Saving Private Ryan is a film that is depicting an actual historical event. And in the brain, when watching that, you know, it's why you watch different genres differently. You know, when you watch Saving Private Ryan, you go in expecting certain levels of realism. And even then, that's what makes that opening to that movie so iconic and horrific, is that it opens with, you know, Normandy and the horrors of war. This is not that. It's a fantasy in a lot of ways. It is an R-rated fantasy, and it's a fantasy for adults. So I certainly wouldn't recommend that kids watch these movies. I would recommend, you know, that adults watch these movies. Older teenagers with their parents can watch these movies. But being aware that the levels of violence are there. But again, you know, there's certainly violence in these movies, but there are a lot of, you know, not as hard R films I've seen that I feel have more overt violence in them than these that people don't really seem to blink at. And again, you know, the films that I've seen that have, I would say, more violence in them, you know, really don't even have as much mythic, you know, iconography and undertones here. I mean, I think George Miller is very intentionally playing with mythic ideas and contrasting them with violence. I mean, it's in how the film handles it. If Miller was approaching this material as if saying that these levels of violence are things that should be aimed for, right? If the characters are sort of being forced into these violent acts and enjoying it, that is one thing. But, you know, if you watch these films, you know, violence is not the thing to aim for. These movies are really about the loss of innocence, and the whole point of the violence and the graphic nature of it is to contrast with the good thing that is there. It is to contrast with peace, which is what Furiosa has at the beginning. It's what they find at the end of Fury Road. You know, Fury Road certainly has a, you know, dramatic final fight, but it ends with them, you know, helping people. And that's sort of the point. So I think the disposition of the filmmaker toward the content and the material is the thing that determines whether or not the violence should be considered gratuitous or bad. And I don't think what Miller is doing is suggesting that, you know, violence is good. I actually think the heightened levels of it is meant to contrast with the very heightened levels of goodness that you see portrayed in different ways throughout the series. And, you know, he paints in very, very strong colors. That's actually Miller's strength. One of his strengths as a filmmaker is that he does nothing subtly, and he paints in very heightened colors. He paints in very heightened themes and ideas and action sequences. And the characters all feel these very, you know, deep and overwhelming emotions at all the time. And all of that is done to prove a point or to make a point or to make the point of the story. And I actually think that the point that he's making in these stories is actually a point worth making. And it certainly has become the benchmark for the post-apocalyptic film. And I would say that a lot of post-apocalyptic films and stories don't actually have the same regard for truth and goodness that Miller does. And that's why the genre has sort of become a caricature of itself.
So let's get back to Mad Max in particular. And I want to talk about some of the first films from when it started in 1975, that was 45 years ago that we mentioned, to 1985, specifically with actor Mel Gibson as the title character, Max. And these are the, you know, classic, quote unquote, Mad Max films. So what's going on in those movies? And do you really need to see them before watching this new one? Now, I will tell everyone, if they're not familiar with the series, that Furiosa is an origin story. And really, Fury Road that we've been talking about shows Furiosa when she's older. And so this is like, how did she get to be where she was? And how did she get to be this rig driver, et cetera? So a lot of people want to know, probably, you know, is there continuity? Can I watch them in or out of sequence? And there's so many series today, whether it's Star Wars or Marvel, that, you know, sometimes people don't know where to start. They're like, do I have to start at the beginning? There's so many films. So how do these films fit into the canon? And I guess like Star Wars, they do have some, I don't know, unauthorized comic books and other things. So what do people need to pay attention to and actually watch before getting to this film in a particular order?
So one of the things that I absolutely adore about this series is that even in the original trilogy, the films have this very loose approach to continuity. Each film builds upon the world and characters, but it doesn't really strictly adhere to the details of its predecessors. And Miller has talked about this in interviews where he said, you know, that when he sits down to make these movies, they were never conceived and they never are conceived with this very kind of strict continuity in mind. I think the only film that has really had to pay attention to a very strict sense of continuity is Furiosa, because it is a prequel to Fury Road. The whole point of these films is that they're a bit episodic, and it's the same concept as, like, you know, reading a Western novel in a Western series. You know, they may follow a particular character, but everything is kind of standalone. And what gets to be familiar to you is the character. They're like folklore in that sense. Every movie is just another story about Max with different shades here. It explores a different facet of his character there. And there's a loose kind of continuity that runs through them. But, you know, that all gets really shot to pieces in Fury Road with a lot of details there. So to talk a little bit about those original movies then, the 79 film introduces us to Max. He's, like I said, he's this police officer in this near future Australia that's, you know, right there on the brink of collapsing due to resource shortages and increasing lawlessness. And this film is effectively his origin story, right? You know, his wife and son are killed. It's essentially this revenge story, and it sets the tone for the series with very intense action sequences. The Road Warrior goes full on post-apocalyptic. The world is fully descended into chaos. Australia has become this wasteland, and Max is sort of roaming the wasteland as this drifter. But he encounters this, you know, small community of survivors who are in need of help from this gang of marauders. And he steps in, and, you know, he always has this bend toward justice about him. And so he steps in to help them. Beyond Thunderdome, same concept. He ends up in the middle of this power struggle and becomes this gladiator in this Thunderdome arena. And it explores themes of civilization attempting to rebuild amidst chaos and all of the moral complexities that come with it. It's much broader in scope than the last two. It has more elaborate set pieces. And while there is a kind of continuity in canon within that original trilogy, each film really can be enjoyed on its own. You don't actually have to watch Mad Max to watch The Road Warrior to watch Beyond Thunderdome. Each film can sort of be watched and enjoyed. In fact, when The Road Warrior was released in the United States, it didn't have Mad Max attached to it. So it wasn't even promoted as a sequel to the film Mad Max. It was just The Road Warrior, even though the character was the same and all that kind of stuff. That just, it wasn't really necessary. And there's a little bit of continuity there. For example, when in the first film, you know, Max gets his kneecap blown off, so he wears a brace in the next few movies. His very iconic car is destroyed in The Road Warrior, this Interceptor that it's called, and it's gone and beyond Thunderdome. But when you get to Fury Road, it's like the whole thing undergoes this kind of reboot, right? The movie opens and Max is there and he's got the iconic car that everybody knows. And so it doesn't really adhere to the continuity of before. And, you know, Miller's been asked about this at times, and again, he sort of just emphasizes that the continuity is not the priority, which, considering where we are, is a very continuity and canon obsessed culture. I really sort of admire these movies for taking these kinds of risks. I really like that Miller is, he doesn't really care. He just wants to make a good movie, and he wants to tell the story that he's going to tell. And if it doesn't line up exactly with what he did before, that's fine, because the story is more important. And I think that's interesting. Like we said, Furiosa is a prequel to Fury Road, so it adheres a little more strictly to canon. Fury Road is clearly the template. The story that Miller has told has been that the story of Furiosa was something that he wrote out before writing Fury Road and actually gave to Charlize Theron so that she would have something to work from. So, you know, these movies, these stories about the character Furiosa have lived in his head for years now. And I think that he's finally getting a chance to make these movies, and he's doing it, and he's having fun while doing it. But even having seen Furiosa, I would say that this is a film that really can stand alone, even amidst all the others. Although I certainly think, and I'm usually a big advocate of watching films in production order, if it is true that the bare bones outline and script for Furiosa was done before Fury Road, this is probably like the only time I would ever say I feel like Furiosa should be watched before Fury Road, because the themes introduced in Furiosa are paid off in Fury Road. I was actually really astonished when watching the film. Right, that whole conversation Furiosa has with Dementis at the end of the film, where he tells her, when he realizes who she is, and he says, you climbed out of the darkest pit, he said, and hope doesn't do that for you. Hate does that. You know, hope doesn't drive somebody to do what you can do. Hate does it. You know, how closely that conversation parallels the conversation she has with Max in Fury Road, where he's telling her to go back to the Citadel, where he's telling her that they'll find redemption. And then Nux, the war boy who's with them, says, you know, this feels like hope. I mean, it's actually kind of remarkable in these movies where there's actually very little dialogue, how much of the dialogue in this film parallels and it sets up things that are eventually paid off in Fury Road. So it feels a little bit like with the 2015 film, Miller pulled a George Lucas and told the end of the story first, and is now sort of going back and telling the beginning of the thing, because the two together, Furiosa and then Fury Road, really, it tells a really a good story.
Well, speaking of that, I just want to ask you two things. First of all, these two films, Fury Road and Furiosa, do they seem really different than the originals with Mel Gibson back, you know, when it started in the late 70s and 80s? And then what's going on with this character, Furiosa, when you said, you know, you should probably watch this one first before Fury Road? And as a matter of fact, I did not realize until we started talking about this film that Fury Road was like 10 years ago or almost 10 years ago. For some reason, I just thought I just watched it in the last 5 or 6 years, but it's been a while. And then when I saw this film, I'm like, I need to go back to Fury Road, because I just remember that it is so different. And again, it is bleak. I think this is very bleak, but it's interesting that you mentioned that conversation when she finally sees her kidnapper and she's seeing him and he's, you know, about to meet his end at her hand. And just the idea of what is driving her, because it seems to me that revenge is driving her, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it is hope. But the hope that she had, the map that she had, all of that is gone. She had drawn that map on herself, where her arm that had that map is now gone. And so what's going on with her? And then, you know, how is this particular set of two films different than the originals? I think we mentioned this, but if we haven't mentioned it, just so people, just to remind them that it's been the same director. He's quite old now, all the way back 45 years ago. It's the same guy doing this. And so what was he trying to say, something different then, back in the 70s and 80s, than he is now?
Yeah, so the story goes that at least the kernel of the idea that would turn into Fury Road, Miller was toying with as far back as the late 80s, early 90s, because Beyond Thunderdome came out in 85. And again, the story is that he had this idea for what was basically a two-hour-long car chase. And if you've seen Fury Road, that's kind of the thing that everybody said about it, right? Like, this is literally just one very long car chase. And that was sort of the kernel of the idea. He wanted to do this, you know, sort of relentless action movie that was kind of like this continuous chase. But it took a long time. It took a long time for those movies to for that film to get off the ground. And yeah, I think, you know, in between then he had done things like Happy Feet, which I think is still like the funniest thing to me, that the guy who made the Mad Max films is the guy who made Happy Feet. But, you know, it just shows his versatility. So yeah, I think logically there's a lot that changes with the person over time. Technology advances, stuff like that. And so when Fury Road came out, you know, it's sort of renowned for this, you know, stunning cinematography. I think the cinematographer on that movie was John Seale. It has this very vibrant color palette. The colors of that movie are ratcheted up. There's a lot of deep reds and blues and oranges and things like that. And it has a very seamless blend of practical effects and then, you know, the new thing, which is CGI. See, the original trilogy was groundbreaking for its use of practical stunts and effects, but Fury Road took that to really to new heights. And it had these action sequences and stunts that feel very modern, but also very timeless. I think this is what happens when you bring a director who has experience doing things the practical way into the modern era and say, okay, make an action movie and here's the CGI to bolster it. He doesn't rely on the CGI. He relies on the practical effects. And the CGI is there to enhance. It doesn't overtake. And it just, watching Fury Road has a very different feel to it than watching a Marvel movie, for example. Another key difference is really the thematic depth and character focus. That original trilogy centers primarily on Max's journey. But Fury Road expands the narrative and includes this more diverse set of characters with a hugely significant focus on the character of Furiosa, this new character that we said was played by Charlize Theron. Furiosa's character brings this whole new dynamic to the story. And, you know, there was a lot of ink spilled when it came out, themes of, you know, empowerment, redemption, the fight against tyranny, stuff like that. Her quest to free these enslaved wives of the villain and find a better world. It really contrasts with Max's more solitary, survival-driven narrative. And it adds this very rich layer of emotional and thematic complexity to the movie. Really, you know, you have Max who he's literally, you know, this is all there in the beginning of the movie. He's literally trying to outrun his past. He's a man who is sort of haunted by all of these people he has failed to protect. And he loses people along the way. He obviously loses his wife and kid. I think it's a daughter in the reboot continuity instead of a son. He loses his family. He fails to protect different people throughout the films. And in Fury Road, when the movie starts, he's running from everything. He just wants to be alone. He just wants to, you know, go as far as he can without other people and run from his failures. Whereas Furiosa, her whole character is trying to get back, you know, she's alone. She's isolated in this world with Joe's, you know, villains and all of, you know, the craziness there, but she's trying to get back to her people. She's trying to get back to her family. And so to bring these two characters whose journeys are fundamentally in opposition to one another, to bring them together and then force them to work together and find commonality simply because they are both fundamentally just, you know, good at heart, creates a fascinating dynamic. And in terms of continuity, you know, Fury Road is both a continuation and a fresh start. It acknowledges the legacy of the original films. You know, Max is still wearing his knee brace, but, you know, the Interceptor is back in Fury Road, even though it was destroyed in the Road Warrior, stuff like that. But the significance of Furiosa's character is key. So you ask what's going on with her. Well, really, she's next to Max. She's without doubt the most memorable character introduced in the series. She really quickly became this sort of iconic character. And, you know, critics raved about her. So she's this warrior. She's this leader. She initially serves as a driver under the villain Immortan Joe. She's kind of one of his chief lieutenants. And she stands out, not just because of, you know, her combat skills and all that kind of stuff, but unlike a lot of action heroes, her motivations are deeply personal and profoundly human. And you see a lot of this stuff come out in the new film. She was born in this, you know, this kind of Eden called the Green Place of Many Mothers. Again, you know, Miller is not subtle in what he's doing here. And, you know, the movie opens in the Green Place and she's reaching for the fruit. It's like, clearly he's read Genesis here. And she's kidnapped as a child. And eventually she's forced into a life of servitude under Joe, the villain of Fury Road. But in the new film, Furiosa, we actually get to see all of the stuff that went into her being taken out of the Green Place, how she got to Joe, how she rose up through the ranks to become the person that she is when Fury Road begins. And so her journey really is one of transformation and really hope. I mean, watching Furiosa and seeing where the film ends, it really does feel incomplete. And that's sort of the point, is because her story is paid off, is finished in Fury Road. And this movie ends, it sort of, you know, does the Rogue One thing, and it ends where Fury Road begins. You know, Fury Road begins, it's obviously following Max, but he comes across Furiosa's path, and she's got Joe's wives in the war rig. Well, the last shot of Furiosa, you know, spoilers, is Furiosa now grown, you know, taking his wives to the war rig under the cover of darkness. So her whole journey there is hope. And of course, in Fury Road, she discovers that the Green Place is uninhabitable. It's gone. And the pivotal moment in the film comes with Max actually stepping in, her relationship with Max, where they, you know, she's given up. She has no hope. And now the guy who, you know, just wanted to get away from people realizes that the only way they're going to find, you know, redemption is really together. And it's Max who says, you know, instead of running, how about we actually go back and free these people and give you a new home? So it's a story that really works on a lot of levels. And, you know, by the time you watch Furiosa and Fury Road, it's a story that should feel very complete.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about mythic themes and archetypes, because we've touched on them throughout this conversation so far. And I wanted to find out what you think about Furiosa making use of myth. And it's interesting because one of the reviews I read actually says this: Furiosa expands the mythic power of the Mad Max universe. So even among secular film critics, they're noting that, and they're noting that, you know, basically he is using various different kinds of imagery, including, as you mentioned, we both touched on the Garden of Eden imagery. And is he doing this with purpose? That he's trying to do this, and he's kind of combining a whole bunch of different kinds of archetypes that are known in culture. So just wanting to find out a little bit more about what you think of some of the imagery that he's using in this film, since that is brought up in other, you know, even secular reviews of this film.
Yeah, we've talked at length on this podcast about the importance of myth, right? Just to reiterate, when we say myth, we don't mean fake stuff. That's usually what people hear when they hear myth. You know, oh, that's just a myth. That's not really the way we mean myth when we're talking about it here. Mythic ideas or mythic themes are these really archetypes that work across time and cultures that make things very timeless. We would say, you know, the Bible story is a very mythic story in that it touches on the human condition across time, across cultures. I can read the Bible story, you know, and I don't necessarily have to go get a degree in biblical archaeology or even a degree in seminary to grasp the power of the story that is told there, because it sort of works in these archetypes. This realization is actually the thing that led C.S. Lewis to faith. He was fond of reading Norse myths and things like that. And it was actually through conversations with J.R.R. Tolkien and a guy named Hugo Dyson that Lewis actually realized, wait a minute, to become a Christian, because he was an atheist at the time, he said, to become a Christian, I don't actually have to give up my love of myths. If anything, what Tolkien and Dyson showed him in their conversations was the story of the Bible is what Lewis would call ultimately the true myth, capital T, capital M, right? It's the mythic story that actually unfolds in time and space. You know, you can go stand where Jesus stood. You can go walk the streets of Jerusalem, stuff like that. And that really had a transformative effect on, you know, one of the greatest Christian minds of the 20th century, that this really took hold with him. And it's no coincidence at all that, you know, some of the best myth makers, if you will, were mythopoetic writers of the last 100 years have been Christians of some, you know, some category or another, some denomination or another. And I think George Miller is certainly someone who is more than willing to tap into those mythic threads. There really is sort of no surprise that when something goes in the direction of myth, it starts to look a little bit like the Bible story, or it starts to incorporate biblical iconography. We talked about this movie with Eden being a major touch point for the green place of many mothers. Max as a character has a very clear hero's journey arc. Furiosa as a character has a very clear hero's journey arc. There's the call to adventure, the being dragged out of the normal, the being pulled into chaos, out of the stability of their life. There's leaving behind the former life, going into the wastelands. And by the way, I think I mentioned this in the article, right? Consistently throughout scripture, you know, the wasteland or the desert places is consistently seen to be the realm of evil. It's seen to be the realm of the demons or the demonic entities. The wasteland, the desert, the barren places, the waterless places is where good and evil come into conflict. When Jesus deals with Satan, when he confronts Satan, it's in the wilderness. That imagery, that's the key. The imagery is the key. And it permeates the story. And you see this, you know, very much with the Mad Max films. There's the trials and tribulations, the transformation, the return to, you know, to as a different person. All of that is part and parcel to Max's journey and Furiosa's journey. Then there are the archetypes, right? The lone warrior, the wandering warrior, the lone hero, Max. And even Furiosa to a degree. You have the tyrant or the villain, you know, Immortan Joe, anti-entity, these oppressive rulers. You have mentor figures at different points in the films. I mean, all of those very familiar archetypes to us, you know, run throughout on the story. Even Furiosa, right? She gets her own mentor figure in this film in Praetorian Jack. It's the stories all sort of turn on archetypes and mythic ideas. And that's the thing about them is if you say, okay, well, what's the story of these movies? Well, it's nothing really twisty, turny, anything like that. The stories are really sort of straightforward and very familiar. And because the stories are straightforward and very familiar, it allows Miller to invest his time in everything else. The story is simple, like Fury Road. The story is simple. It's a 2-hour long car chase. I mean, it is the definition of a quest. Go from point A to point B. What motivates the characters to go from point A to point B? It's the kind of story that a screenwriter should be able to write, you know, in his sleep. But where he emphasizes and gets interesting is in the characters. It's in the world design. It's in the dialogue, which these movies have a very distinct way of talking. You know, they're in a lot of ways, it's funny. Like in Furiosa, the villain who has what they call a history man with him. The history men are respond. They're these guys who have the whole history of the world tattooed on their bodies. And they're just founts of knowledge, and they're there to, you know, tell people, you know, all of these ideas and details and things like that. It's like when the villain finds a word he doesn't know, he like goes to the history man, or what does this mean? And the history man explains it to him. And the dialogue is very funny because he'll get words wrong and things like that. But, you know, that's just a fascinating, clearly thought went into that, right? It's not as simple as, oh, you know, he just opens a book. He's got a dictionary that he walks around with. No. He's got a dude who is a dictionary, and he has a dictionary tattooed on himself. It's just, it's interesting. And that's where having the basic mythic story shines, because it allows Miller to actually step in and do things differently. It's a familiar story, but told in a way that we've never seen it before, with all of these symbols and mythic archetypes done differently. And that actually contributes to why I think these films have a kind of longevity, because they really are timeless in that way.
Well, one of the main characters in this particular movie is the actor Chris Hemsworth, which most people will know from his portrayal of Thor in the Marvel movies, but he kind of does a really over-the-top camp performance here as a bad guy. And I want to talk about the bad guys in this series, at least in the last two films. There's Immortan Joe, and then there's this Dementis now played by Chris Hemsworth. And what's going on with these characters? Why do you think Miller is trying to say with them? Especially, I think Immortan Joe is just a really vile character. He's got these war boys that are look like almost like skeletons who will, I think, be suicide bombers for him. It's kind of bringing that in, that whole idea of the suicide bomber. And they are just like so loyal to Immortan Joe. And they're all kind of really weird, freaky, odd characters. And also, I don't know if there was any symbolism, but when we first meet Dementis, and throughout the film, he has this little teddy bear with him that I guess that belonged to some of his kids that back in the old days, his family was killed. And he starts out with this white kind of parachute cape. And as the film goes on, it gets red and dirtier and dirtier. I don't know if that was any kind of symbolism on the part of Miller, but kind of give us a little bit of the arc of these bad guys, who they are. Do they represent anything in particular?
Yeah. So the villains of the series, and I would say, you know, this is all throughout the series has fairly memorable villains across the board. Obviously, in the past decade, Immortan Joe has become really iconic. He has this, you know, you've probably seen a picture of him. He has, you know, long white hair and this almost like it's like this horse teeth mask that he wears. And it's all very freakish and grotesque and monstrous. And I think Miller is absolutely saying something there, right? If you watch the films and you notice, you know, there's all of the good guys, so to speak. I mean, they may be weird, but they're generally not some type of aberration. They're not some kind of grotesque fiend. All of the grotesque fiends tend to be villains. You know, like Immortan Joe, he just looks like a monster. Dementis is crazy, but he's also very freakish. When we first meet him, you know, he's actually, he looks a little bit like Jesus. He's got this, you know, white robe on. He's almost seen as like this messiah figure leading this biker horde. You mentioned the teddy bear. So the teddy bear is actually kind of funny. Back when Fury Road was a thing, when it was being made, the story of Furiosa was originally seen as like an anime project that George Miller was working on. And there was some concept art from that that had Dementis wearing this teddy bear. So the teddy bear, from a production standpoint, it's actually just, it's the only part of the character that was really carried over from the anime. It's from the original concept art and they kept that. But in the story, like you said, it's, you know, now he's crazy and we don't know if it's actually true. But what he says is that the bears belong to his own family, which he lost. And so there's a tether there between the, you know, the war-torn landscape, and it becomes almost symbolic of his relationship with Furiosa, where when he originally finds her, it's almost like he wants to make her, he wants to use her to get to the green place, but he also kind of wants to make her one of his kids. It's very strange.
Yeah, it's almost like a little totem type of thing. Is it?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Charm for him or something?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's that. And it sort of becomes, you know, symbolic of that relationship with Furious, because it comes back very powerfully at the end of the story as well. But the villains consistently all throughout, monstrous characters, characters that become more monstrous as time goes on. You see this with Dementis, the character that Chris Hemsworth plays here. What I think is actually interesting about Dementis, right, over against Joe, Joe is a force to be reckoned with. You know, he looks it, he is it, he's frightening. He's actually a frightening villain. Dementis, on the other hand, you know, he's very polished, or he tries to be, but he's also kind of an idiot. He's always mispronouncing words. And, you know, that's kind of a comedy thing there. But it's also meant to show you that this dude is, he's playing a role, right? He's in over his head. And you see this actually when he rolls into the Citadel. And this is when Furiosa, you recognize the Citadel, and then Joe appears and you're like, oh, this is those characters. This is where he is. And he just sort of says that he's going to take the Citadel over. and Joe annihilates his biker horde. And it's sort of the opening shot of this war that will play out across the movie. But it's the first time you really get the sense that, oh, this guy's playing a part. He's nowhere near as good as he thinks he is. He's nowhere near as powerful as he thinks he is. And, you know, Furiosa figures that out too. We're later in the movie when she goes back to Joe and says, you know, when you find this guy, I want him. And she knows that, you know, Joe's going to pull it off and get it done. But the villains have consistently been these kinds of monstrous characters. And when you find the good guys in the Mad Max movies, you know, they're actually kind of normal. And I think that's part of the thing that Miller is going for with these films, where, you know, this movie is so much about the loss of innocence. In The Green Place, there are families. They're normal. There are kids. You know, they're enjoying life. They're doing what everybody does. It's ordinary, ordinary. Just like Max in that original film, you know, even though society is collapsing, he has a family. It's simple. He has friends. He has buddies. He has a job. But then in the course of the story, those things are all taken away from him, right? Both Max and Furiosa are ripped out of the ordinary and thrown into this dark, chaotic world of despots and tyrannical rulers and freaks and brutes, and everything's grotesque. But that's what they're trying to get back to. And in Fury Road, you know, the end of the movie, that's part of what makes that so powerful, is that, you know, when Joe was ruling the Citadel, you know, all of the people who were freaks, were deformed, but just weren't him, didn't have his power, you know, he oppressed them. You know, he would only give them so much water. That's the, you know, the scenes in Fury Road where they're clamoring for the water when he finally gives it to them. And then at Fury Road at the end, you know, it's the rejected wives, the wives that he rejected. They turn the fountains on and, you know, the water flows freely. And when Furiosa is on the platform and it's being raised up, all of the wives, they're pulling the people up onto the platform with them. It's this overthrow of tyranny. It's this overcoming of the dementedness. And then, of course, you know, what makes Fury Road, you know, so powerful there at the ending is, you know, even though Furiosa is literally ascending, she loses Max and she can't find him. And when she finally looks down at the crowd, you know, he's down there and he's walking away. And they have that moment where they sort of acknowledge each other. But it works. It works thematically. The villains are there to reinforce these ideas. It's there to reinforce that goodness is actually very ordinary. So many times we think of ordinary and good as a bad thing. But this is why it's so difficult to write Superman well, right? Because we always feel the need to make the dark stuff, the demented stuff, very attractive and sexy even. When really, goodness and ordinariness, that's the most complex thing you can have. The dark stuff, that's all, you know, a sham. It's all just, you know, pretty to look at. But there's no substance there. And this is why, you know, if you go to these movies and you cut out the beginning and the ending of, you know, Fury Road or Furiosa, and you're only there for the action scenes, I mean, fine, you're there for the action scenes, but you're also missing the point of the story. You're missing the point of the journey the characters go on. You're missing where they end up. And ultimately, I think you're missing the thing that Miller cares about, which is this exploration of goodness. And I think you know, as a cultural apologist, one can really, really mine that for a lot of gold in getting someone to Christ.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note than post-apocalyptic stories, this week we have a holiday that's National Donut Day. So what's your favorite kind of donut? Are you a cake donut or just old school?
I'm pretty old-fashioned, so just an old-fashioned cake donut. I'm pretty basic.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast once again, and our listeners can look forward to more film reviews with Cole this summer as we have more series giving us our latest installments of the next adventure in these long-running series, including upcoming at the end of the summer, Aliens. So thanks again, Cole.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 395 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written an online exclusive feature film review for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Furiosa, Mad Max, and the Modern Apocalyptic Myth. You can read his review for free at our website, equip.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.